The Transportation Committee will come to order. Today we've got a an overview from the University of Minnesota Center for Transportation Studies. And after that, the Minnesota Transportation Alliance is going to give us a little overview on where we're at right now on Minnesota roads. So with that, Mr. Johns and Mr. Ward, if you want to come to the table. Oh, and members, Ms. Parker from MnDOT supplied myself with some answers to questions that were asked in the last meeting. We'll make copies of this material and make sure that all the committee members get it. Mr. Johns.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I'm Bob Johns. I'm director of the Center for Transportation Studies at the University of Minnesota. Very pleased to be here again to present some research results to you all. Legislature was very important in creating our center, so we want to be a resource, and I always credit Senator Langseth for back in 1991 helping establish the Center for Transportation Studies. Our mission as a center is to advance the land-grant mission of the University of Minnesota in the field of transportation. We've defined transportation very broadly, and that mission is research, education, and outreach. And as a big research university, we have many disciplines to call on to look at transportation problems and emerging issues. We support the education by the departments of transportation professionals, and we have a lot of outreach to get the knowledge of the university out to people like yourselves and the professional transportation community. Including this year, we had two seminars for legislators, and Senator Carlson and Senator Olson attended, as well as many House legislators, and we got good reviews. So what we're going to do today is just touch on two topics. We decided to have seminars because you can't really do justice to the extent of the research that we're doing and have the kind of interaction. So we're just scratching the surface on two topics that the chairman has asked us to talk about. One is transportation and growth. And the other is transportation technology, and we're going to focus on safety. And I'll do the transportation and growth, and Dr. Nick Ward is going to do technology and safety. First of all, just to give you an idea of the types of issues that we do deal with over the years that we could also come and present about in addition to those of today. We're doing a lot on transportation planning, you know, that looks at how congestion is growing, how our region is growing. I'll talk a little bit about that today. We have current projects looking at accessibility, how that's changing over time. We also have a large project from the American Institute of Architects looking on how better to integrate transportation facilities into the design of communities. We have a lot going on at the Humphrey Institute in transportation finance and economics, and actually on Thursday, you're going to hear Lee Munich and others talk about transportation finance, so I will not touch on that today. We have a major federal institute, our Intelligent Transportation Systems Institute, that looks at new technologies, and Nick Ward is going to talk about some of those today. But we have traffic operations, advanced traveler systems, all kinds of technologies that we're looking at in the future for managing transportation. We have a focus on traffic safety. Again, you'll hear some of that from Nick today, but we're part of the Towards Zero Deaths program. We staff that program, which really has made a difference. We also have a federal Center for Excellence in Rural Safety at the Humphrey Institute. We've long done research on the infrastructure, on pavements and bridges. We have some new initiatives that are turning the Minroad facility up near Monticello into a regional and national center for pavement research, and our bridge research continues to look at new materials to lengthen the life of bridges. Emerging areas that just in the last year that we've gotten involved with are alternative fuels. You know, we've long had an environmental program going on, particularly looking at stormwater and vegetation and so on. Alternative fuels, as you all know, is a very hot topic, and we have some leading researchers that that was a topic at our seminars that got reviews. So I know you're hearing about that in other committees as well. And finally, transportation security. We have major grants from the Department of Homeland Security and Transportation Systems Administration. So what we're trying to do with all these programs is leverage our state funds, be very entrepreneurial, attract federal funds, build on that knowledge that we have to address state problems and be a national resource. So what I'm going to talk about related to growth today is a study that we completed a couple years ago on transportation and regional growth. So I'm just going to highlight this. The slides are in your packet. I'll go through it quickly. But this was a comprehensive study on how transportation and growth relate to each other. We had an interdisciplinary team looking at six components. MnDOT, Metropolitan Council, the Minnesota Local Research Board were the key sponsors. And out of this study came 16 research reports that are all on our website. And what we did at the end was produce a summary synthesis report, which is in your packet, which is a very readable 30-page report that gives the highlights of this study. And I'm just going to go through that quickly of what we learned. We did this because of economic competitiveness, quality of life, those things we all care about, but also specifically because when this study began, sprawl had become very politicized. The questions about the role of transit and transportation, automobile, we tried to get a handle on just how growth and transportation are linked together. Our current situation, as you know, is one of continued growth in this region. That's good news, but transportation certainly has suffered with limited expansion of the system. So we have more commutes that are longer than 40 minutes. We have projections of travel delays doubling over the next 20 years, and we have funding issues around transportation, as you all know. So what did we learn from this study at a very high level here? We looked at how travel is occurring in the region. The region really is much bigger than the seven counties. Many of these things you know, but we confirmed and have data and a lot of statistics to back this up. The Twin Cities metropolitan area really is 19 to 24 counties if you look at how commutes travel. We have looked at the policies, the state, regional, local policies, and even though they're not maybe intentional, those policies, the incentives do encourage spread out development. Congestion is clearly an issue in the region, but our researchers feel it's more of a symptom than the problem, but it is a very significant problem, so it needs to be understood and addressed. The problem is more of a system in which transportation and land use decisions have been made with little reference to each other, or they've not been thought through how they would impact in the region. And the types of the suburban land use decisions that have been made often require a car-centered transportation system with few options for alternatives. Continuing on what we learned, the growth is good, as I said, and congestion actually sometimes is an indication of growth. So there's some positive signs there, but there are negative signs, particularly in the environmental area. And one area that our researchers looked at is the impact of our development and our transportation networks on the water systems. You know, that water is sort of rising to the top as a critical issue for Minnesota in how we develop. We also looked at how other centers in the state are developing and found very similar patterns. Our geographer, John Adams, really says that the old distinction between rural and urban is disappearing, that the same kind of dynamics in our rural centers are happening that are happening in the Twin Cities. Development on the edges, the rural, Brainerd, for example, is a hub of communities around it, same kind of transportation congestion impacts in those that are thriving. There's others that are not thriving. We said there's no silver bullet in terms of solving all of our transportation problems. We look particularly at transit, and while transit is not a cure for congestion, It's very successful in serving activity-rich destinations, and I'm going to come back to that. You know, particularly the two downtowns, University of Minnesota. Transit is a very important component of the system. We looked at how people decide to take transit and found that where they're going has a bigger impact than on where they're coming from. So back to that activity-rich destinations.
That's true.
Just continuing, we also learned that people care a lot more about the time they spend than the actual distance. There's a time budget concept that's being used by researchers that when people exceed that, that's when they start determining different locations, different jobs, maybe different modes. That time budget seems to be around 70 to 75 minutes a day. The Twin Cities, what's happening in the Twin Cities is happening all around the country. People spend, on average, about 20 to 25 minutes commuting and 70 to 75 minutes in total travel. What's interesting, that has not, even as congestion has increased, those averages have not changed that much, which tells you that there's some land use things adjusting to that situation. We also looked at the costs of transportation in this study, and $27 billion in our metro region, the seven-county area. We categorize those costs by internal costs, the costs that you as an individual pay, government costs that government pay for transportation, and the external costs, which are things like pollution and congestion that are really not being borne by anyone right now. Most of the costs for transportation are 84% are internal, paid by the users. What that says is that people perceive high benefits from using autos. They're willing to pay a lot for that. However, the government costs and the external costs of a car-centered system are growing rapidly. We looked at revenue forecasts, and the current funding mechanisms are not going to produce enough revenue to meet the government costs of transportation in the next 25 years. We looked specifically at transit, that it can be very beneficial in reducing those external costs imposed by car travel that are not being paid for right now, pollution, congestion, and so on. And it also offers travel choices. So that's a very broad, high-level bullet of findings that we had. Our researchers recommended some directions that we should go, full cost pricing and more market choices. Full cost pricing, particularly economists feel that the investments that you make, the costs that you pay for services should be transparent in you paying for that service. And we found in transportation in the Twin Cities that 70% of the road-related revenues are not related to how much the users travel on the system. And those fixed revenues in that sidebar, state aids to local government, local property taxes, motor vehicle registration taxes, those are not related to how much a person uses the system. So recommendations are more transparent pricing there. Then on the land use side, back to the point that there are incentives for the kind of development that's occurring out on the fringes, that our researchers feel that the full cost of that development ought to be borne more by the buyers and commercial developers. That gets controversial, but other states have had impact fees that start saving money to help for the investments that are come down the road for the infrastructure. The theory here is that full cost pricing lets the market work, leading to better decisions and more efficient uses of resources. The second category of recommendations our researchers came up with is more market choices, that we work with policies that accommodate trends that are already evident in the marketplace. And one thing that's continues to grow in the marketplace is a desire for downtown-like development. Even in outlying suburban areas, creating that downtown environment is good for transportation because, as I said earlier, transit particularly is helpful when there's activity-rich destinations to travel to. And employment, shopping, entertainment, having those clustered as opposed to being distant apart allows people to go to those. The way they go to St. Paul or Minneapolis can take transit and then travel to those destinations by foot, by bus, whatever. You're not just solely dependent on your automobile. We feel that these destination centers should be served by a combination of improved roads. The road system is very important, but with a clustering that expanded bus service and carefully designed rail lines help produce that type of environment. So that's a very quick overview. All these reports, this summary, is on our website, our Transportation Regional Growth Study. We've given this presentation to several groups since it was completed. I think it was very influential with the Chambers of Commerce coming out with transportation as one of their top issues. So I'll conclude, Mr. Chairman, and be available for any questions before we move to Nick Ward.
Thanks, Mr. Johns. And, yeah, I'm glad that the Chamber has, put this as one of their objectives this year. Hopefully they put together a package that does the trick instead of half-stepping the way that they traditionally have done. Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of my questions was from a couple slides back where one of your, where do you go from here with full cost pricing? Second bullet point, you said potential home buyers and commercial developers should pay the full cost of infrastructure development. And yeah. I'm kind of wondering where you came from on that, because I know in my area of Anoka County, developers would argue that they pay way more than their fair share of infrastructure development. So given that, is there a lot of ambiguity around the state of how that, how, when, and where gears off, who pays for what?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, it's not a popular concept with developers, as you can guess. What other states have done, right now the exurban land is very cheap, so it's attractive to people for lower-cost housing. If that part of the region continues to grow over time, there's demand for more road systems, for sewers, for parks, and the infrastructure. The concept of impact fees is that those initial buyers of that start banking for that future infrastructure. It's complicated, it's controversial, but if those first buyers out there and the developers started paying for those long-term infrastructure costs, our economists feel that better decisions would be made in how we use our land and develop.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Where were you 2 years ago when I needed you? I actually had that bill, and it was driven by developers because, again, in our area, developers feel like they're paying way more than they should. And I'll even use myself as an example. Maybe that's not a good example, but I did the old farmstead up in East Bethel and developed it. It's just five lots. We had to put in a cul-de-sac. Mm-hmm. But I built a 10-ton road, and there's not even a county road anywhere near within miles or a city road that's a 10-ton road. Mm-hmm. I have ditching systems and NERP ponds and stuff that doesn't exist anywhere for miles around. I had to dedicate an area for a turn lane for the future, even though arguably you wouldn't need a turn lane in that particular situation for five lots. And and I had a bill that would actually call for those, whether they're impact fees, whatever you would want to call it, because I think developers want to pay for their fair share, but they don't want to pay for more than their fair share. Mm-hmm. So I think you're onto something. You know, if we can have somebody like you guys come in and give an independent analysis of that. But 2 years ago I had just such a bill, and developers are hungry to be able to have it in statute. What do they have to pay up front so there's not a moving target? And in my case, Mr. Chair and members, it was a moving target. It changed. Every time we submitted to the county or the city, they'd come back with something different. You'd satisfy four bullet points, and they'd go, well, as long as we got you on that, we think you should put in this, this, or this. So I think if you're talking to developers that are saying they don't want to pay a fair share, I don't think that's true. I think they want to get there.
Well, Senator Jungbauer, I think that the experience of some of the other people around the table is that they don't want to pay. Senator Bonhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm a former Planning Commission member in Minnetonka, and I know that when there are developments, we do assess the developers for things that seem like what you're referring to. So I'm curious, do you actually have numbers put to this? What kind of numbers are we looking at? What would an average homeowner or home buyer who's, say, purchasing a house at a certain amount. Have you done that?
Our researchers have done some of that, and I'm not, Mr. Chairman, Senator, not the person qualified. I think if we could arrange a presentation by Professor John Adams, who's geographer professor, who's looked at what California and other states have done. I think there was a case here, and people, other people in the room might be more aware of it, in Eagan, that was a test case where they were proposing to go farther, and it was not allowed. So there's some legal issues, but other states are exploring that, and we would be glad to get you more information about that.
Thank you. I'd like that.
Okay.
Any other questions for Mr. Johns? Thank you very much.
Okay. I'd like to introduce Dr. Nick Ward. Mm-hmm. Nick works very closely with our Center for Transportation Studies. As I said earlier, we have received a very large five-year program on intelligent transportation systems. And one thing that we look at is new technologies, particularly related to safety. And Dr. Ward is director of our Human Factors Interdisciplinary Research on Surface Transportation Program, the Human First Program. And he's going to present some of his research results today and be available for questions.
All right, Dr. Ward, before you get going, Mr. Johns, I did have one other question for you. What's the level of funding that you receive through MnDOT? And what's your overall budget, and then how much of that is money that comes that this committee appropriates to MnDOT?
The Transportation Study Board in 1991 put language in MnDOT's budget that would give the Center for Transportation 0.1% of the funds appropriated to MnDOT minus the state aid funds. Mm-hmm. And that language capped it at $800,000.
Okay.
So we reached that cap in about 1995. So that's our operating funds. What we said when we made that proposal to Senator Langseth and others is that mm-hmm. we will leverage those funds and multiply them many times. Our total budget this past year was $20 million. So we have gotten a great amount of external funds. We've long had a strong research partnership with MnDOT and coordinated a RFP every year with our researchers. And that ranges in dollar amount in terms of how much they invest in the university, sometimes based on the federal funds that they get, you know, that pass through. Mm-hmm. But it's in the range of $1 million to $3 million a year of research. The Minnesota Local Road Research Board also has a strong research program, particularly directed to engineering issues of local roads. So we've been probably attracting $500,000, $700,000 a year from the Local Road Research Board. Mm-hmm. Above that state investment, which is, you know, less than $5 million, are all the federal funds we've attracted, foundation funds, associations like the American Institute of Architects. Nick Ward, for example, has attracted funds from Nissan that he might mention. So we're trying to leverage those state funds and feel that we've been pretty successful. We are one of the, I would say, top 5 to 10 centers in the country in terms of the breadth of our program and the funding that we've attracted.
Thank you. Dr. Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, committee members. This is my first time in the State Senate, so I'm pleased to be here and to talk to you. The topic I've been asked to talk about today is to give an overview of intelligent technology that's being used around the world to improve traffic safety. And by intelligent technology, I mean not things like speed cameras and that type of stuff. I'm thinking of technology which involves sensors and computing to support the driver in perceiving hazards in the environment, deciding what safe behavior is, and then engaging the appropriate behavior. Just to start off with some facts about traffic safety itself, and then I'll talk about some examples of technology that's being developed worldwide. First, some facts. The World Health Organization is estimating that by 2020, traffic crashes will be the third largest cause of death and disability worldwide. In fact, by 2020, traffic crashes will result in more deaths and disability than wars or AIDS. Talking presently, in the U.S., for ages 2 to 33, traffic crashes are the largest single cause of deaths for that age group. 25% of all deaths in the U.S. for people aged 2 to 33 is a result of a traffic crash. Lastly, for a larger age group, 2 to 76, it's the largest cause of unintentional injury-related deaths. So traffic safety is a very important concern. And just before I move on, I would like to try and move away from simple numbers and facts, which can be a bit benign, and show you a traffic safety commercial produced by the French government, which gives a rather shocking demonstration of a crash, which, although it's in France, is not an untypical crash for rural areas, such as rural areas in Minnesota. It's a high-speed crash on a curve. If you're easily upset by shocking crashes, you may not want to watch this. There's no gore. It's not a real crash. It's all done with visual effects. But it's one of the examples that the French government uses to convey the importance of traffic safety to its citizenship. So I wanted to show it here today just so that you get into the mindset of we're not talking about numbers, we're talking about very graphic, serious crashes. Of course, that assumes this machine will work.
Well, doctor, nobody turned away, but a couple people fought to get better seats. So. Oh.
So the point of that was to not only get your attention, but also to focus on a specific kind of crash that the technologies I'll be talking about can address. This crash, as described in the French subtitles, was a result of the first car driving too fast and coming across a curve in a rural area and losing control, and the second car driving too fast, not seeing the crash car ahead and running into it. And some of the technologies I'll talk about now that are being developed worldwide would have prevented that crash.
Thank God.
First, looking at Minnesota, where are we with our crash safety record? This is the number of traffic fatalities presented as a function of 100 million vehicle miles traveled. So it's the number of fatalities as a function of exposure on the roads in Minnesota. And what you can see is that over the years, the traditional types of interventions that we have put forth, improving vehicle design, improving our road design, various enforcement programs, and better driver education, have all pushed down the fatality rate substantially. But we're now faced with the problem that each subsequent year, it's harder and harder to reduce the fatality risk any further. We're reaching a floor effect. So we need to find some new ways to push through this floor effect and to keep pushing down the fatality rate. And what I'll be presenting today is some suggestions for how we can use intelligent technologies to get a step function to further reduce the fatality crash risk along with the other types of interventions that we traditionally deploy. When one considers the types of technology that you may want to deploy in a traffic system to reduce fatal crashes, you need to look at the cause of fatal crashes. This is data from 1998 to 2000 Minnesota, fatal crashes only. Looking at the cause of the fatal crashes, you have the first two categories, driver state. That's where the driver involved in the crash was drunk, tired, distracted, on drugs, or some other kind of driver state variable. And the second is a driver behavior variable, driving too fast, not yielding, not stopping at the stop sign, and so forth. The last two are to do with faults with the vehicle and something about the environment, slippery roads, bad fog, for example. And what you see quite predominantly is that the two driver type variables, driver state and driving behavior, what we call the human factor, is by far and away the largest cause of fatal crashes in Minnesota and in the U.S. and in the world. So when we're developing technologies, we need to be focusing the technology on the human factor and trying to support that driver. To do so, we need to think about what does a driver do when they drive. Well, they have to perceive the driving environment and the hazards in it. They need to decide what is an appropriate behavior to engage in that environment, and then to execute the appropriate response. And this data here shows that when you look at the cause of crashes in terms of failure of the driver to perceive something, the failure of the driver to decide the appropriate response, or the inability of the driver to respond appropriately, you get crashes occurring at all those levels, but it's mostly perceptual problems and decision problems. So your main bang for your buck is to develop technologies which support the driver in perceiving hazards and deciding how to be safe. Some of the existing technologies which are under development, near development, and there are some early prototypes coming out in some vehicles now, are two I present here. The one on the left is an example of a collision warning system. It's a system where the vehicle has a forward-pointing radar or some other type of sensor which can detect hazards before the driver can. It can also detect hazards in front of the vehicle if the driver is fatigued or distracted. So in the case of the French crash, the second van would have been warned about the presence of that vehicle before the other driver noticed it. What typically happens is a vehicle is driving along with its radar pointing forward. For example, in fog, the radar will still see an obstacle you can't see in fog. And if it detects an obstacle, it gives you an auditory warning, and perhaps some icon may flash up as well to give you a redundant cue. So then you're alerted by your smart vehicle that there's an obstacle in front of you, and you should then decide what to do. It's helping the driver perceive hazards in front of them. The second example on the right is a lane departure warning system. It's designed to help the driver perceive their location within the lane and give them advance warning when they're approaching a dangerous curve. It is also based on radar. It also uses vision-based camera systems to track the lane markings, not always effective in the snow in Minnesota, so there are systems which use global positioning systems which track the location of the vehicle on the road and still give information about where they are in the lane and can give them advance warnings if they're coming too fast to a curve to get through safely. In such an instance, you may hear a warning such as this.
Curve, curve.
And you'd be warned in advance of the curve that you're approaching too quickly or under dangerous conditions, and you could slow down appropriately. So those are some examples of intelligent technology to support the perceptual process for the driver. There are also examples of systems which are helping the driver in making safe decisions. This is an example of a study which the university is currently involved with, a nice combination of state and federal funding, as Mr. Johns alluded to earlier. And the goal here is to help drivers on the minor road of a through-stop intersection with a four-lane interregional corridor. And the goal is to help the driver to decide what gaps are safe to take. If you look at the analysis of the crashes we're having at intersections of this type, it's because people are stopping correctly, but they're deciding to pull out when the gap's not safe and they're getting hit. So we're trying to develop intelligent technology to support the driver to decide when to take a safe gap and to hold off when the gap's not safe. And the logic goes like this. We have traffic coming down the intersection. We have a whole bunch of sensors on the side of the road which detect the approaching traffic. That produces what we call a state map. It's a virtual representation of where all the traffic is at that time at the intersection. Some calculations are done as to whether there's a safe gap or not. And as the minor road vehicle pulls up, there's a display on the side of the road which is giving some information to the driver, essentially saying it's not safe, don't go. When the system decides that it's now safe to go, the display turns off and the vehicle can move to the next stage and repeats the same process. So that's an example of intelligent technology supporting the decision stage.
Yeah.
Moving on to an example of systems which are currently available for supporting the performance of the driver, helping them to control the vehicle. I have two examples here. The one on the left is an adaptive cruise control system. You may have heard of those. They are available on some of the higher-end lines of vehicle. Adaptive cruise control is like a cruise control. On the top part of the left side, you set the speed you want, and it functions like a normal cruise control system. But you can also dial in how close you want to follow. So you also set your headway. And the system has a forward-pointing radar and is doing calculations of your closing speed and your closing headway. And if you have no car in front of you, you will drive at your normal speed that you set. If you have a slow vehicle in front of you, it will automatically slow down for you to maintain the headway you've set. So it helps drivers maintain their speed control and their headway control. The version on the right is not necessarily currently available as a commercial product, although it is very well developed in Europe as a research concept. It's the idea of autonomous, intelligent speed adaptation, and the idea there is that you have a vehicle which is equipped with GPS so that the vehicle knows where it is on the road network, and the map it uses to represent the road network has all the speed limits marked on it. And the vehicle will do one of a few things. It will either remind you what the speed limit is, it will tell you what the speed limit is, and you have the option to then have your vehicle not exceed the speed limit, or it will not let you exceed the speed limit, period. And you can imagine which ones people prefer. They can also moderate this system so that it's not your speed limit that it's referring to, it's weather conditions. So, for example, if you're on a 65-mile-per-hour highway, but there's sleet and ice, it will give you a lower speed limit. So it's a way of helping drivers select the appropriate speed. It's actually been estimated to dramatically reduce fatal crashes because speed's a major culprit in fatal crashes, but of course you have the issue of driver acceptance. Another area of technology has to do with the driver state. There's actually technologies being developed here and in the U.S. which can tell when the person's fatigued or distracted, and there have been attempts, and there are probably new initiatives coming forth out of NHTSA to try and tell when you're drunk, not by breathalyzing, but by how you're driving. So this is an example of a system which uses a video camera to find the driver's face, to track the head movement, to track the eye movement, and from looking at blinks and where they're looking, they can tell whether the driver is distracted or fatigued, and they can do a couple of things. They can either warn you, the top right is the passenger vehicle example where you get a beep and a red triangle if it thinks you're fatigued. The bottom is the commercial truck driver version of that. There's also suggestions that if you have, for example, a collision avoidance warning system that's set, for example, to warn you if you get within six seconds of a hazard, if it thinks you're distracted, it will extend that to 8 seconds. So these systems may work together.
Well, Dr. Ward, what kind of impairment detection systems are currently available? I know that this kind of facial recognition type is probably down the road.
Correct.
A little bit. But what do we have right now, especially in regards to DWI?
Where we are now is there are some very heavily researched devices which do fatigue detection from eye blinks and do distraction by where your head's moving. Honda's developing a system that they're going to be putting to their vehicles soonish. In terms of alcohol impairment, there have been several projects attempted in Europe to predict when a person's becoming too drunk by how they change their driving behavior. But that's still very much in the research stage. There has been talk about using special material on the steering wheel to sense the presence of alcohol in the sweat, but that hasn't moved forward to anything nearly commercial. Right now, it's still very much a research concept of if we can, after the fact, when we get people drunk or sober and put them in a study, we can see the drunk people drive differently. Mm-hmm. So can you reverse that and have your vehicle smart enough to watch how you're driving and detect a shift in your driving behavior, which is indicative of some kind of unsafe impairment level, like alcohol. But that particular area is mostly now just a research area.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Chairman. a few more slides to show you. One area that technology is becoming more focused on is high-risk populations such as teens. The rationale being that they have the highest crash risk of all demographic groups by a long shot, especially during the first 1,000 miles of their novice driving period, the first 6 months. And one can reliably find factors which are very common to teen driver crashes. Those involve speeding, alcohol consumption, and not wearing your seatbelt. A nasty cocktail, which leads to a higher rate of fatal crashes amongst our teen drivers. And there's technologies out there that can be used to support teen drivers, and the university is undertaking a few of those areas right now. One area that we're exploring is trying to use technology to augment and support the GDL program here in Minnesota and across the states. The graduated licensing program is one that has certain requirements that teen drivers have to satisfy before they can get their license. It tries to protect them longer and give them more experience before they're licensed to drive. Some of the examples are that they have to have a minimum number of hours of supervision by an adult. They can't use a cell phone while they're driving. The problem right now is that none of this is supervised or formally recorded. It's all on the oath of the parent that they supervise them. There's no way of knowing whether they're on the cell phone or not. Parents don't know whether they have teens in the car or not, passengers in the car or not, when their teens are away from home. And with technology, there's sensors and devices out there which will let you actually record objectively hours of supervised driving, whether cell phones are used or not, whether passengers were used or not, all unobtrusively. And that would enable you to give a more formal record of completing the GDL. Once they completed the GDL.
Dr. Ward. Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Dr. Ward, in your previous slide, when you referred to the teen driver, the previous one, of the teen
nasty cocktail,
speeding, alcohol, and non-use of seatbelts, have you found that the non-use of seatbelt actually causes a crash or causes the fatality after the crash?
No, it's more of a mitigating factor. So you've got high-speed crashes and not wearing a seatbelt, and the seatbelt's more of a factor to the outcome of a crash than the cause of the crash.
Thank you.
Although there's some speculation that the persons who don't wear seatbelts have other traits which lead them to want to drive faster, so it's almost a personality cluster.
Such as white males between the ages of 18 and 25?
Not for me to say.
Okay. That's the demographic that is the highest noncompliance of seatbelt use.
Correct.
Doctor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This slide here just talks about how you can support teens specifically in relation to their specific crash factors. This is a system that we're developing currently at the university, which has the teen driver use a biometric thumbprint so the vehicle knows who's driving, so that the system's not on when the parent's driving. It tracks the vehicle's speed and knows the speed limits, so it gives feedback to the teen driver when they're speeding, reminds them of the speed limits. It also adjusts those, as I said, for weather conditions, and it also gives curve speed warnings to the teen driver as well. The last feature that we have for this teen support system is that we are able to introduce a seatbelt interlock, so the vehicle will not start unless the teen has the seatbelt on. We also get the parents involved because parents are a critical component to safe teen driving. Not only do unsafe parent drivers produce unsafe teen drivers, having parents who are involved in their teen driving experience end up being safer drivers. And what we do with our system is we actually text message the parent if the teen has been noted to be speeding for an excessive amount of time or if he takes off his seatbelt while he's driving. The parent can also look at a map after the fact, which gives an overview of what Timmy did and where. Last couple of slides, and then I'll close up. Those are areas that are currently being researched now or are nearing market. Moving to the future, we have the ability now to actually not only identify who is driving and how they are driving, but also where they are driving. And I know that sounds scary, but if you ignore that fear, there's a lot of usefulness you can get out of that kind of system. For example, we can evaluate the performance of the driver in real time. We can possibly detect when they're impaired in real time. We can detect violations in real time. And we can detect crashes in real time. These are all good things for traffic safety, although they may be a little scary and unpopular. Automatic enforcement would motivate people to be safer, and it would step around a lot of the issues with speed light cameras and so forth. A big, big bonus, which I'll finish off with my next slide, is that it lets you bring in incentive programs. Rather than always using technology as a stick, you can use technology as a carrot and reward safe behavior, rather than using technology to reprimand bad behavior. You can use this technology to enforce licensing compliance. You can also use it for vehicle control. So some car companies are using it. For example, if the car knows it's going to crash, it will automatically brake for you before the driver can to reduce the impact of that crash. And lastly, if you have automatic emergency response linked to your vehicle, when the car knows it has crashed, it can dial into the hospital and get ambulances out to you quicker than if you were lost somewhere in rural Minnesota waiting for someone to find you. So I think there are many opportunities that we could look for with technology. This is a fairly controversial quote by my old supervisor in Canada. The point he's trying to make is that if we can use technology to add incentives, the driving public will want the government to make driving safer. So you could imagine having technology which could do things like give you an annual report card on how well you drove. And you could get deductions on your insurance from it. You could get state tax deductions for it. And a whole bunch of other incentives which would change the mindset of the drivers to want to be safe because they get concrete rewards for being safe. And the technology gives you a way of doing that objectively. I'm not suggesting that technology is a panacea, of course. There are some caveats. You want to be able to use technology where it's needed, not simply because you can build it. We need to make sure that we don't design technologies to introduce new hazards. This is a cartoon showing about 7 or 8 different technologies all in one car. Now the person's flying a space shuttle and can't pay attention to the road. So we need to have some moderation with that. And drivers are sometimes uncooperative. They don't always behave as you'd like. So there's research that needs to be done to make sure that the technology we're proposing will be used appropriately by drivers. We know, for example, that with ACC, if people know that they got better control over the headway, they will decide to follow closer than they would normally. We also know that if you give people technology, they may become reliant and complacent with that technology and stop doing the normal behavior and rely on the system to do it. So if you have a blind spot detector, which is a system which looks for vehicles to your left, normally you turn left, you look behind yourself. If you have a system that does it for you, you'll stop checking. Those aren't things we want to do. We want to have these technologies supporting the driver, not replacing the driver. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Doctor. Senator Rolstein, I almost called you commissioner, sorry.
MnDOT, I don't know if you would know the answer to this or not, but they've been looking at some smart technology on some of the snowplows and stuff. Could you maybe say where that's at?
The smart plow research was basically trying to put a collision avoidance system onto a snowplow so that the snowplow wouldn't drive into vehicles in heavy snow or foggy conditions, as well as trying to help operators of snowplows see through whiteout conditions by superimposing on a head-up display the boundary lines of the lane they're in, as well as graphical representations of objects that are in front of them. That was a successful research project. The Intelligent Vehicles Lab, my sister lab, did all the technical work on that, and I know they've got a couple of systems operating up in Alaska right now. But given the recent climate changes in Minnesota, our ongoing research program with that project came to an end because we weren't getting enough snow to actually do the research. But that technology is being used by other organizations such as Alaska right now.
Thank you, Doctor. In that regard to snowplows, it seems like most of the accidents are not caused by the snowplow driver. It seems
Correct.
Like it's other people who are slamming into the snowplow.
Is
there any type of technology outside of what we have right now on our snowplows that we could be using to keep people from trying to pass snowplows when the weather is not so good?
There are concepts out there like the collision avoidance warning system. If a vehicle had that following a snowplow, they would be warned about the snowplow's presence. The technology behind that also allows you to do things, for example, you can imagine having a snowplow equipped with some intelligent equipment and the passenger vehicle behind it, and they could talk to each other. The snowplow could say, "I'm a snowplow, I'm up here," and the passenger vehicle may sense the driver trying to overtake and then give the driver a warning. So one thing I didn't talk about is that you also have the technology for vehicles to communicate to each other. And that gives you a greater latitude in the kind of things you can do to support the driver of both vehicles that may otherwise crash.
And Dr. Ward, this is kind of my last one, unless Senator Jungbauer stirs me up again. But back to this key interlock systems for
yep.
people who are habitual DWI offenders. Is there technology in play today so that we can keep them off the roads?
Why do I feel I need to be careful about how I answer that one? There is technology commercially available that serves as an interlock.
Mm-hmm.
there are states out there that require interlocks for repeat DWI offenders. There's a lawyer at the School of Law, Dr. Steve Simon, who's an expert on this area, and I would defer to him for the definitive statement. Mm-hmm. But there are ways around some of these interlocks. And some of the interlocks are designed to be operated while you're driving. And I know of cases where the sober repeat DWI offender was trying to comply with the interlock while driving, and the interlock was designed in such a poor way, they had a crash due to being distracted trying to operate the device. So the technology is there. There are states that implement it. Mm-hmm. I don't know enough to comment on their effectiveness. I do know that some of them are not necessarily designed to be used while you're driving.
Mm-hmm. And who was the person that you said you were deferring to?
Stephen Simons.
Okay,
the
thank
School
you.
Of Law.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Dr. Ward. I just was wondering if you could give us a little more information on collision avoidance, warning, how it works. I'm very familiar with aviation products, traffic awareness, terrain awareness, that kind of thing.
It's probably very much the same kind of animal. The way collision avoidance works, at least in the Ford, there's a forward-pointing radar. Some companies may use LIDAR, but it's usually a radar. And it's LIDAR is a laser-based radar unit. And the sensor passes on the information to a processor which calculates the trajectory of the vehicle with relation to the hazard and the rate of closure. And the trick is to come up with a threshold to trigger on. It's easy to measure distance and where the hazard is. Do you warn a person when they're 3 seconds away, 2 seconds away, 1/2 second away? That's the trick. Because if you warn people when they're too far away, they're going to perceive it as being a false alarm. Or they may be aware of it. And people don't like systems that tell them what they already know. So if you have a system that goes too early, yeah, I can see the car, don't tell me. And they don't like the system because it's an annoyance. So you want a system which is as close as possible to the actual crash so that if they haven't reacted by the time you get to the point, they probably aren't aware of the hazard, but give them enough time so they can still respond. The trouble is that people of different capabilities can respond with different speeds. So the trick is getting a threshold that is not so early that it annoys people, not so late that it's useless.
Senator Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Dr. Ward, the slide again that's on the high-risk population and the teens that have the highest crash risk, do you have any feel for and I'm trying to get at the training that new drivers get, like new drivers of other ages, how that would compare with teenage drivers, for instance, if you don't start driving until you're 20 years old, or in other countries where you start driving at perhaps 18 years old, or even in places where, like countries where they have much more extensive driver's training. Does that make a significant difference, or is it a small difference?
I'm not aware of any research that's compared different types of training for these age groups. I do know if you look at countries that do have more rigorous training programs, like France and Britain and Japan, they do have a better crash rate than we do. I think that's a very good question. I simply can't answer it at this point. I do know of literature as well which points out some of the weaknesses of the current training programs, but they haven't actually compared across different training paradigms to come up with a definitive one. There are experts out there, and I'd be more than happy to point you to those people who do focus on driver training specifically.
Thank you.
Yeah, Senator Carlson, you bring up a good point. You know, the kids in your neck of the woods probably don't have access to be behind the wheel a lot, like up in Senator Scoy's district, where you know a lot of kids work on the farm and drive back and forth to the fields when they're 13
Six.
And 14 years old, and so yeah, it's about experience. Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Ward, how receptive have the automotive companies been towards some of these safety features, both domestically and the international automotive companies?
They're falling over themselves to get on board.
Seriously?
They see safety as being an added value to the products they're selling. Many of the projects that have been done on these devices have involved OEMs. In fact, many of the funding mechanisms require an OEM, with the goal that it's not simply totally a blue sky project within the confines of the university. It's actually got an OEM that can maybe take that and make it a commercially viable product. So the OEMs are very much on board on this. In fact, they may be OEM, a car manufacturer, or a supplier to a car manufacturer. In fact, they may be, I won't say overzealous, but they see some of these ideas as being so good, they get a little protective of them.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonner.
Dr. Ward, is there any difference between the American automotive companies and the international?
Senator Bonoff, I do believe there's a difference between a Ford and a Mercedes.
I meant to the receptiveness of and the safety issue.
Oh, okay.
It's a good question. Before I came to Minnesota 5 years ago, I spent 10 years working in Europe with different car companies there. I would say that the Europeans, for some of these technologies, are a bit further ahead. For example, the Europeans have spent a lot more time looking at impairment detection technologies, and they're also very much on board with the intelligent speed control, the one that won't let you speed, whereas the North American OEMs are probably more focused on the collision avoidance, lane departure type applications and don't really want to talk about intelligent speed control.
On what? I can't hear you.
Senator Bonoff, I wasn't trying to be flippant. I was just, there's a huge difference in the European market. I mean, they were the first ones to come out with side air impact bags and all this other stuff that protect vehicle occupants, and we've been kind of behind. Detroit's pretty slow to move on anything, whether it's flex fuel vehicles or this type of research. I mean, they're just they're still stuck in the 50s, I believe. Senator Fischbach.
Mr. Chair, Dr. Ward, is this the same kind of technology? Have you seen that commercial where the car parallel parks itself? Is that the same kind of, I mean, so, and I don't even know if that's an American car or if it's something else. I guess I'm not sure.
It's a Lexus, Senator.
Okay. Is that the same kind of technology? I mean, could it be expanded on?
It has the same core technology. It's used for a slightly different function than some of the other systems I talked about. So it has sensors to locate where the vehicle is. And it has a way of processing that information to locate where the vehicle should be. So the basics technology, the hardware is the same as, for example, a collision avoidance system. It's just a different application of that same technology.
So, Mr. Chair, Dr. Ward, that's something that could be expanded on. In particular here, it's a high-end car that
does. I mean, okay. there are some car companies which are debating, do you actually relinquish full control to the car and have it drive you to work in the morning? There's some nervousness about going that far, but there has been talk of that. Years ago in Europe, when they began looking at way of designing vehicles to detect if their driver is impaired, one of the options was that the vehicle, if you didn't respond to the impairment warning, that it would automatically slow down and pull you over and wire ahead to the nearest police station. So your imagination is your only boundary as to what
lock the doors and keep the vehicle or keep the occupant inside till they show up and let them out. And
I don't think they went that far, Mr. Senator. But that is possible too. All these things are possible with this technology. It's just which particular functions and approaches do we want to take to satisfy our most important needs right now in traffic safety.
Mm-hmm. Well, Doctor, I just looking at the statistics in fatal accidents, knowing that the majority of those are on rural two-lane roads, there's a specific demographic that has the highest incident rate, And along with that, the four leading fingers of death, you know, alcohol, speed, seatbelts, and inattentive driving, it would seem like there should be some technology out there that we can, right back to that the guy with his mug on your, that guy right there. If there's a way that can, I mean, who is working on these types of technologies and can we get them, like, say, within the next couple of years instead of waiting 5 or 10?
This system from Honda, I'd imagine, would be this concept from Honda. This is actually a different project than Honda's project. But this concept, I would imagine, would be out in a couple of years. When I spoke about this technology here, which is meant to support teens and, in particular, teens in rural environments, which is why we're focusing on curve speed warnings and speeding, there's no reason. This is existing now. We have a prototype at the university that does this. We're trying to find more funding to move this toward a more deployable device and to leverage this technology with teen driver training to get a synergistic effect going on. So this is all available right now in this state. And in terms of the video capture of the person's face, we have experts in the center that are experts at image processing, and we could very readily incorporate our own version of where the person is looking, are they distracted or are they fatigued, into this particular device. So we have the abilities right now to move forward with this.
So what kind of price tag is on this teen driver portion?
Mr. Chairman, this is currently a research prototype, so it's hard to give a price point equivalent to what it would cost a family to put into their vehicle. The current technology that we use in the research prototyping is probably a few thousand dollars. But when it would be moved to a more commercial product, it probably wouldn't cost more than a smartphone.
Then what?
Okay.
Smartphone. A smartphone is a large. I turned mine off, otherwise I'd show you. It's a large. It's like a small miniature computer which functions as a phone, but also can be used for Excel spreadsheets and other functions. The idea is that all teens have a cell phone, so if they could have a smartphone which functions as their support system in their car, you'd have much better take up.
Interesting. Any other questions, Senator Gensi?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Ward, I'm going to take us from the highly technical aspects that you've been talking about to probably maybe a simplistic approach toward teen driving. I know it worked very effectively for myself when I was going through pilot training, and that was a simple logbook. Have we done any pilot programs or testing as far as how just using a simple logbook to keep track of teen driving and the number of hours they've compiled and to achieve this, say, 1,000 hours or 1,500 hours under supervised conditions, and how that relates to a reduction in accidents?
Thank you, Senator. I do not recall any research which actually looked at the benefit of logging hours. The GDL requirements do stipulate a number of hours, and one of the arguments is that GDL isn't as effective as it could be because there is no formal logging. There is no way of auditing the logging. It's all done by an honor system, in effect. And the suggestion that we're putting forward is that you could address your very point by having the system automatically log for the driver. So it's done automatically and objectively, and we'd be able to know that, in fact, Timmy drove 12 hours rather than saying he did 20, for example. And then we could answer your question by looking at how does learning progress as a function of the number of hours actually experienced and logged.
But, Doctor, you're talking about Timmy driving 12 hours, and four of those were 20 miles an hour over the speed limit. I don't think that the driver's going to log down that he was speeding for, but, the type of equipment that you're talking about is going to take into consideration the speed of the vehicle, the RPMs, the acceleration rates, the deacceleration rates.
Right.
If you want to save money on your car, maybe throw one of those in. You'll find out why you're going through the brake pads so fast. Kids like doing that. You know, it's either all the way to the floor or break all the way to the floor.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Ward, what I was talking about was right after they received their learner's permit, such as for us as pilots, we weren't allowed to solo in an airplane until we had so many hours of experience. And that would be supervised experience logged by the parent. And I know it myself as a parent. I wouldn't allow my 16-year-old new driver to drive 20 miles an hour over the speed limit in any case, or to do anything illegal behind the wheel of the car. What I'm talking about here is and I like how you would incorporate technology into the process. You know, say the parent could key in a PIN number, mm-hmm. that would also log that this is the parent, he's with Timmy when he's driving, and log in the time gain some experience that is supervised, that is restricted, and complies with the law.
Mr. Senator, we have kind of a continuum. We could have the technology simply logging hours of supervised driving and move away from that to add extra benefits by actually quantifying how well Timmy drove. So the parent and the GDL authority would not only know that Timmy has completed the GDL requirements, he did it well. He doesn't speed. He doesn't slam on the brakes. And those two things together, I think, would be very powerful.
I think that'd be good information to know. I wish it would have happened like 12 years ago. I could have.
For yourself?
No. I think for my kids. So, Senator Carlson.
I think you covered most of this before, but on the teen driver support and the GPS system. Now, Hertz used to, or maybe they still do, have what they call the never lost system. Mm-hmm. And I know I've had the experience with it in Los Angeles going back to the airport, and it knew what lane I was in. Mm-hmm. And it reminded me to get into the right lane to make an exit, and I didn't because I wanted to pass another car, and it got more forceful.
Yeah.
As I was ready to pass up the exit. Yeah. Now, I would assume that this kind of thing, right now you can buy almost the state-of-the-art GPS for $400, and I think there's a lot of automobiles that now have them available in the U.S., and if you look at some other countries, they have the Japanese cars that have a large screen with some very detailed information on them. Is this what you're thinking that might be incorporated as standard equipment in the cars?
Thank you, Senator.
I'm mainly not thinking about teenage drivers. I'm thinking about everyone.
Ooh.
We weren't proposing route guidance systems for vehicles because that's not a safety-related device. The use of GPS for other purposes is very useful. If you know where your vehicle is, and if you know with enough accuracy in terms of where it is in the lane, then you can do a whole bunch of things that you would normally rely on vision-based sensors or radar to do. You could get warnings when your vehicle is too close to the lane boundary. You could get vehicle warnings if you're too close to or going too fast for a curb that's coming up. You could give warnings for any number of reasons, and we're actually doing that right now. So using that same technology, the GPS technology, it actually lets you to do many of these types of systems without using vision-based and radar-based systems. And that's why we use them in Minnesota, because vision-based sensors don't work as well in the snow. Moving back to the teen thing very briefly, we would rely on that GPS technology for the teen system, not for the route guidance functionality, but because it lets us identify where the teen is. But the trick is to actually get the state speed limits accurately placed into the digital map. That's the trick. Because once you can do that, you can do speed warnings and speed control, heaven forbid, if that's the way people wanted to go. So GPS is very important as an enabling technology for many of these functionalities. But route guidance systems per se need not be in every vehicle.
Well, thank you, Mr. Johns and Doctor, for coming over this afternoon. We appreciate it. We're going to move along here. If committee members have any further questions, you can always call Mr. Johns, and he's always more than willing to talk about transportation. So thanks again.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. As I said earlier, we have many experts in many areas, so we certainly could arrange many of them to come over. We also would be glad to host some tours of the university. In fact, Dr. Ward has a very sophisticated driver simulator that he does a lot of his research on it.
Does anybody want to see the video crash again?
Okay.
I thought Mr. Thomas would say yes in the back of the room. But anyway. All right, thanks.
Thank you.
Next, we're going to hear from the Transportation Alliance, kind of the way that they see the state of the state's transportation system, and hopefully some ideas on how to move forward. Who wants to be first? Ms. Thomas. And if we're working off printed material, if you could let us know which group of printed material it is.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Richard Thomas. I'm Director of Government Affairs at Ames Construction and President of the Minnesota Transportation Alliance. There's been a lot of discussion lately about different transportation funding proposals lately and what they're going to cost all of us. And unfortunately, there's been little discourse over the cost of doing nothing. And I'd like to shed a little light on that today. Congestion and unsafe roads are taxing all of us. They're taxing our businesses, our health, the environment, and our quality of life. Our unmet transportation needs are $1.5 billion a year, and that includes the new MVES revenues. This number will grow by $150 million a year just due to the inflation that we have on construction projects, although that seems to be getting better. That means inflation alone will eat up 5 cents of our gas tax this year. And because of the rising costs and the lack of long-term funding, the list of unfunded projects in our MnDOT district's 20-year plans total $21.5 billion. And I believe all of you have one of these books. If you look at starting after page 12, we do have a list of all of those projects. The failure to put a long-term funding plan in place is taxing us. Congestion in the metro area is costing commuters over $700 a year, and it costs $2 a minute to move goods around town. So as you can see, every minute of delay is adding cost to the products that we depend on. I would call it our congestion tax. In fact, it's not uncommon anymore to have the cost of moving products actually more than the products itself. And the cost on human life due to unsafe roads and bridges, particularly in greater Minnesota, is one that I think all of us would find unacceptable. The cost of doing nothing is particularly high when one looks at jobs and economic development. The construction industry employs over 46,000 men and women in Minnesota. Most are family-owned businesses like ours that are crucial to local economies that they're located in. These are not minimum wage jobs either. The folks that do these jobs are highly skilled and well paid. In short, these are the kind of jobs that one can raise a family on. If you would all look at the graph on page 10 here, you will see that MnDOT's construction budget will fall from $800 million to $483 million this summer, a 40% decrease. In terms of job losses, it could exceed 50,000. It wasn't so long ago that we were faced with the closure of the Ford plant, which resulted in 4,000 lost jobs. This was a big blow to Minnesota. And many of you tried to do what you could to save those jobs. Even the governor, to his credit, went to Detroit to meet with Ford representatives in an attempt to save those jobs. If nothing happens between now and July, we're facing the equivalent of nearly four Ford plant closings. The good news is, unlike the Ford plant, the decision to save or not save those jobs will be made in St. Paul rather than Detroit. The legislature and the governor can work in a bipartisan manner to pass a comprehensive long-term transportation package this session. We will not only save these jobs, we can save lives and ease congestion at the same time. According to the Bush administration, 47,500 jobs are created for every $1 billion spent on transportation. While our current situation may seem bleak, the solution will continue to pay dividends for us for generations to come. In closing, I want to urge all of you to do the right thing to pass a bill this session. It will not be a bill you'll regret. In fact, I believe that you would find such an endeavor would be something you'd be proud of for years to come. And I hope you will remember that many Minnesota families are counting on you.
Thank you. Ms. Donahoe.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Margaret Donahoe. I'm the Legislative Director for the Minnesota Transportation Alliance. And in addition to the report that I think you all have, there are also a few handouts that are separate from that I'm going to refer to as well. Funding for transportation in Minnesota, of course, involves a partnership among local, state, and federal levels of government. Local governments have to rely on local property taxes for meeting transportation needs. And we've found that reliance on local property taxes for transportation has increased significantly over the years. And there is a chart here, it's one of those separate handouts, where you can see what's been happening since 1992. You can see the growth in the amount of property tax revenue going for local roads and bridges. We've also heard from counties that have not previously issued local bonds for highway projects who are starting to do that increasingly. They're issuing local bonds, which, of course, have to be paid back with local property tax revenue. In addition, local governments have also been advancing funds to MnDOT to help pay for trunk highway projects. So when there are trunk highway projects that are important for local communities, but they're far down on MnDOT's priority list, local governments have found it important enough to advance local funds to the department and then wait to get paid back when that project is programmed. According to MnDOT, the department is scheduled to pay back local units of government almost $50 million in principal and interest on previously advanced funds between the years 2007 and 2014. As the legislature works to reduce property taxes in Minnesota, one key area for consideration is the amount of property tax burden in meeting local road and bridge needs. An increase in revenue from statewide sources such as the gas tax and license tab fees, with the revenue going to help county state aid and municipal state aid systems, would go a long way toward mitigating the need for additional property tax revenue. Of course, it has been a long time since our 20 cent per gallon gas tax was increased. The last increase was in 1988, 19 years ago. And since that time, inflation has eroded the purchasing power of the gas tax to about 12 cents per gallon. One of the other things that I wanted to call your attention to is page 9 in this report. Again, there's a chart that we put together that shows what's been happening with the gas tax, the license tab fees, and the motor vehicle sales tax, because those are the constitutionally dedicated revenue sources that are going into our highway trust fund. The gas tax does continue to be the workhorse of the highway trust fund, generating the most revenue into the highway trust fund. And you can see that the revenue, it's the green line at the top, has been flattening, and that is a departure from the past in Minnesota. But we also think that some of the discussion about the imminent demise of the gas tax is a little premature. The Department of Finance is forecasting about a $4 million increase in gas tax revenue from fiscal 2008 to fiscal 2011. And so while there is a flattening, we're not sure that there's any imminent dramatic decrease in gas tax revenue. Revenue from the motor vehicle registration tax, however, has gone down in actual dollars significantly. In fiscal 2005, the license tab fees generated $496 million. In fiscal 2007, the projection is for only $477 million, or a decrease of $19 million. Estimates from the Department of Finance show that the tab fees are not expected to go back up to $496 million until fiscal 2011. And, of course, as you can also see from that chart, the motor vehicle sales tax revenue has not performed as expected in recent years. So that's another source of revenue that we rely on that we're not sure how well that will perform. We certainly agree that in the future, as a greater percentage of the population drives more fuel-efficient cars or cars that use alternative fuels, there will need to be alternative strategies looked at, like possibly a mileage tax of some kind. However, in the immediate future, we still think there's a great deal of value and a great deal of need to increase the gas tax. And the other chart that we put together for you, which looks like this, shows that even if the gas tax were to remain flat in the next few years and then start to take a dramatic drop about 2010 and continue down to basically nothing by 2030, an immediate 6-cent increase in the gas tax would still generate $2.2 billion for our Highway Trust Fund. The members of the Minnesota Transportation Alliance have been advocating for a long-term comprehensive transportation funding package for many years. We believe that Senate File 5, authored by Senator Murphy, provides the kind of comprehensive funding package that is really needed to address our backlog of highway projects and to implement the Met Council's 2030 plan by 2020. Other states are moving ahead. They recognize the economic benefits of a major investment in transportation infrastructure. Illinois has put together a program called Illinois First that combines school infrastructure improvements along with road infrastructure improvements. Indiana passed a very major transportation funding package, major moves, that will allow for 400 construction projects and was instrumental in getting the Honda Motor Company to locate a plant there. In California, there have been numerous plans, Rebuild California, Strategic Growth Plan for California, where they have recognized the need to invest hundreds of millions of dollars in their infrastructure. The Trans-Texas Corridor is another huge plan to expand I-35 in Texas. And in Arizona, the Maricopa County Regional Area Road Fund has been a significant source of funding for both highways and transit that involves a voter-approved half-cent sales tax on business activity in the county that was just recently reapproved by voters. Since 1997, 14 state legislatures have increased their gas tax a total of 17 times. And most recently, in 2005, the Washington State Legislature passed a transportation funding package that included a 9.5-cent per gallon increase in their gas tax phased in over 4 years, along with a vehicle weight fee on passenger cars, a light truck weight fee increase, and an annual motor home fee of $75. And we believe that Minnesota will continue to fall behind other states, reacting to project delays and trying to keep on a 23-year schedule for needed improvements while other states attract new businesses and economic development. We know from the very strong vote on the MVEST constitutional amendment in November that Minnesotans want action to improve our transportation system. We urge the legislature to pass a strong, comprehensive transportation funding package this session so we can start to make progress on that goal.
Thank you, Ms. Tannehill. Senator Salzman.
Yes. To Ms. Donahoe, one thing that I think that the voters always want to know is we talk about the millions of dollars that a gas tax would raise, which is really documented well in this proposal. Can you help, though, in terms of us perhaps explaining to people what is that real impact to the owner of a car? I think I've heard $50 per year or a dollar a week. And having that kind of perspective would be especially helpful. But in addition to that, when we talk about our businesses, do you have any specific examples of what is the cost to our larger businesses when they cannot transport goods to market, when they cannot get their goods to the airport because they're stuck in like, you know, traffic? Having real specific examples like that, it's the sound bites, because I think this is excellent. It really makes the case, but having the stories behind it and how it's really going to impact drivers of cars would be extremely helpful. Do you have any other examples today?
Mr. Chair, in terms of the impact on people, you're absolutely right. The calculations that have been done with an average fuel car and the average amount of miles that people drive, the estimate has been that a 5-cent increase in the gas tax would cost people about $50 per year. So that, you know, equates to not a whole lot per day, kind of the equivalent of a latte or that sort of thing. And in terms of the impact on businesses, I think we have had some anecdotal information about companies that have had to take detours around to get to roads that can handle the kind of products that they're shipping or to avoid congestion. We don't have any statistical information, but we can certainly pull together those kinds of stories.
Thank you.
And Senator Saltzman, you have to understand that's just the gas tax component of an overall package. And what we've tried to do is sprinkle a little bit across the top of everything. And I kind of figured it out for myself. I drive a lot more than most people, probably twice as much as the average motorist. And I drive, I've got two vehicles. They're both older, where they would, they'd still be on the old depreciation schedule because I don't intend on getting rid of them. But, you know, for somebody that drives a lot of miles, it's about $425 a year.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And that's a lot of miles.
Right. Right. That unbalanced approach is very helpful, and I think that sometimes with the gas tax, though, we're not. I think that's something that a lot of people hear millions of dollars about and don't really see the impact on an individual basis. So thank you for clarifying that. Excellent.
Senator Dole.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Thomas, did I hear you say that a 5-cent increase in the gas tax would be eaten up in the first year with just construction inflation costs? Is that what you said?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dahl, for the last few years, both on building and transportation construction, inflation has been running about 11%. And that's been primarily due to the cost of materials. In China right now, they are building the equivalent of our interstate system in 15 years. They're doing the same with their ports. So, I mean, we've had increases in steel prices have been 100% in some years, concrete as well. So we have seen the last couple of months that it's starting to, get a little bit steadier there. But it's been 15%. So you figure if we have, if our unmet needs are $1.5 billion a year at 11%, and that was the administration's numbers, that would be $150 million a year. And at $30 million coming from each penny of gas tax, right now we would have 5 cents of gas tax getting eaten up.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Thomas, also, and I guess this could be for Ms. Donahoe, too. Ms. Donahoe first, maybe. The chart you have on page 9 shows the three sources, the MBEST, tab fees, and gas tax, and then you have the inflation effects on each of those. Do you have a chart that shows, in aggregate, all three of those added and the inflation aggregate? I just was trying to calculate that out here, and it looks like it really takes a dive in those out years. And you know, if you look at the numbers for the gross numbers without inflation effect, it doesn't look all that serious because it's at least flat. It's not a tax increase or not a decrease. But when you add up the inflation, it looks like there's a major separation, and it's compounded by having the three added together. Do you have a chart that may show that?
Mr. Chair, we could certainly get you a chart that shows that. I think the biggest problem has been with the gas tax because it is charged per gallon and doesn't reflect any increases in the price. So that has been has taken the biggest hit in terms of inflation.
Okay.
And Minnesota is unlike the state of Illinois, who charges a sales tax on their gasoline. And so the state of Illinois, they just kind of did the same thing that we're talking about, sprinkle a little bit across the top on everything. But when it hits that sales tax, that's a lot of money. And when the price of gas goes up high, well, they get more money in their coffers. So they're not awash in cash, but they're in a lot better shape than we are in.
That's right. And then, Mr. Chair, the follow-up question to Mr. Thomas was the inflation rate that's used in those three numbers, I'm assuming, is something related to the Consumer Price Index. But what's the inflation rate that you might apply to construction over that same period? And you know, obviously, the inflation rate affects the collection of revenue with probably the Consumer Price Index, but as you mentioned, it's extraordinary with construction costs. So there's got to be even an aggravated effect there because construction costs, I would imagine, are much higher than the Consumer Price Index.
Mr. Thomas.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carlson. Yes, this is true. The last 3 years have just been particularly bad. I mean, a decade ago, inflation on construction projects really wasn't that much different than inflation on anything else. But the last 3 years, it's been really tough. The good news is the last couple of months, things have kind of leveled off. But it's hard to say whether that's due to, you know, right now in the winter with less construction, that could be related. And also, too, I think, you know, there's been an increase in the supply of a lot of those materials. Particularly after Katrina, it was tough to get concrete. And steel prices have been, there's been a lot of demands on steel prices over the last 3 years as well. But, I think the point is even if we could cut that inflation in half, say 5%, we have so many big-ticket projects that are out there that we don't have the funding for. I mean, you take Crosstown, for instance. Which is, about a project that will be between $250 and $300 million. 10% on that is $30 million. Even if it was half of that, you're still $15 million is going to be added, would be added to that, just that one project in 1 year.
Thank you. Well, let's keep moving. Mr. Woffler.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm James Woffler here, representing the Minnesota Transportation Alliance. I also represent Associated General Contractors of Minnesota. I'm going to talk about three future transportation funding alternatives that are likely to be discussed and explored as early as your next hearing, and then talk about some other needs which are paramount goals of the Alliance and many other groups relating to this legislative session's dealing with transportation funding. First, three funding alternatives I'm referring to are value pricing, public-private partnerships, and a mileage-based tax. value pricing is a form of road pricing, which is a fancy way of saying tolls, in which motorists pay directly for driving on a particular roadway, and value pricing, in essence, is a market-driven, if you will, pricing mechanism to reduce road congestion by varying the toll charged for driving during certain peak hours of road demand. There are a wide variety of ways to implement these tolls, and the advent of new technologies has made it easier to do without inconveniencing motorists. But I would be remiss if I didn't point out that the equipment costs for these new technologies to implement value pricing are relatively high, and some critics raise the privacy issue when it comes to transponders or GPS systems that are used to track vehicles or vehicle locations. But value pricing is something that can be done now, can reduce congestion, provides choices to motorists, and may help us to avoid the need to add additional capacity in certain heavily traveled corridors. Whether it will be a robust revenue source is yet to be determined. And as a funding source, it is a localized, segmented approach to funding, which means it may help solve one problem when there are many problems that remain in even a particularly long corridor. Public-private partnerships are another way in which some states are responding to the need for more innovative methods to fund transportation systems. Public-private partnerships refer to contractual agreements between a public agency and a private sector entity or entities, allowing for greater participation by the private sector in the delivery of a transportation project and maintenance of that project. Over 20 states now allow this, including Minnesota. The first steps in such partnerships have already been undertaken in Minnesota, with the legislation allowing for design-build contracts, and US 52 in Rochester is a good example of its success. But there are proposals to go far beyond this. In franchise agreements where private entities would actually maintain and essentially run traffic corridors and charge a toll for the use or be paid by some other funding method. Such agreements could involve highway contractors, private developers, and financial institutions. We think this approach may deserve some serious consideration for some future large projects, but it is not a panacea for meeting our transportation challenges, and it has had mixed reviews. It appears to be working well in California projects, State Route 91, but in Virginia, the Dulles Greenway project is one that has, for many, been a disappointment. The Dulles Greenway project is a 25-mile-long toll corridor. The original maximum toll for that corridor was to be $2. The current toll is $2.90 during the non-peak hour and $3.25 during the peak hour. The current proposal is to raise that by 2012 to $4.50 each way, or $9 for a round trip. There has been no funding increase since the toll was initially put in. Fairfax, Loudoun, and Prince William counties, which are served by the toll road, now have some of the largest commute times in America. And in fact, Prince William County drive times are exceeded only by the four boroughs of New York City. The mileage-based tax is another funding source that is now being explored. It's the concept of charging motorists for the number of miles driven rather than for the type and amount of fuel used. Variations on this include charges by type and weight of vehicle, time of day use, and route of travel, that is, heavily versus lightly used corridors. The governor's budget proposes a pilot project for the next biennium in this regard. Trends suggest that the gas tax at some time in the future will no longer be a reliable revenue source as different fuels and technologies come into play. There is a lot going for this potential revenue source, especially because it would continue to grow naturally as the population increases and vehicle miles driven rise every year. It is also a funding source that would have statewide application to a statewide problem. It does have problems, however, which would have to be considered. If it was to replace the gas tax, a constitutional amendment would be needed since the mileage tax would not have a constitutional safeguard. There is the issue of out-of-state drivers, which means that implementation in Minnesota alone might be impractical. There are privacy issues, which will inevitably be raised by some regarding the type of surveillance needed to implement such a tax. And most importantly, from our standpoint, the transition to this kind of tax is years away. There is simply no practical revenue stream available over the next three or more bienniums. All of these alternative funding mechanisms that I've cited have some promise, but really only in the long term. In the short run, say the next 6 years, it would be difficult to imagine any widespread reliance on any of these funding mechanisms to significantly address the major unmet needs in our state roadways. Remember that MnDOT has estimated that most of the unmet need over the next 20-plus years will occur in the next 16 billion dollars, on our trunk highway system alone. There are two other critical needs we feel we must stress as you tackle the challenge of providing a major transportation package. First, we need to provide more funds to local units of government because their unmet needs are great too. These local projects are also extremely important to the construction industry. Many of our smaller contractors, particularly in Greater Minnesota, rely on these projects, and these contractors and their employees are important to local economies, as Richard said. When these projects become delayed, sometimes for years, the local community suffers by not getting the improvements and by layoffs that can have multiplier effects on local economies. And second, there is an absolute need for action this session to permanently increase dedicated funding. I don't think we can stress enough that the longer a permanent funding fix is delayed, the more Minnesota taxpayers will have to shell out, because the problems are not going away. They're just going to get worse and more costly. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Woffler. Mr. Woffler, one real quick question. How much of the governor's bonding program is going to be spent on county roads or municipal streets?
How much of the governor's bonding program is going to be spent on on what?
County roads and municipal streets.
I don't believe any of the governor's bonding
that's,
program.
You are correct. Thank you.
Well,
Senator Olson.
I think the Constitution only allows bonding for the trunk highway system.
That's exactly right. And so we're dealing with a...
We're dealing with just trunk highway bonds in that proposal.
Right. And so that doesn't do anything for those small contractors. That doesn't do anything for Senator Fishbach's constituents out there in Painesville. That's correct, right?
That's
okay,
correct.
I'm just making sure that I got all that correct. And the next question, Ms. Donahoe, you had mentioned that there's currently $40 million of repayment to local jurisdictions. Where did you come up with those numbers at?
Mr. Chair, the DBR is close to $50 million, and the information comes from the Department of Transportation. They have a schedule of all the debt that they're paying between 2007 and 2014, and included along with debt service on trunk highway bonds is the need to pay back local governments that have advanced funds for projects in previous years.
Okay, is there somebody in here from MnDOT? Because we need to, Ms. Parker. Ms. Parker, Ms. Parker, we need to know, and maybe you can just take a quick note in regards to Ms. Donahoe's statement about closer to $50 million than $40 million. If we could get an exact breakdown on that and exactly what that number is and why the department decided to go outside of Chapter 161.361, I'd like an explanation. I think the committee has deserved an explanation.
Mr. Chairman,
I'm
Betsy Parker from the Department of Transportation. I have a breakdown of it here that I would be happy to leave with you. It's my understanding, and perhaps I'm incorrect about this, but I thought that the limit of our repayment was $10 million a year, but that there was not a maximum limit on the debt we could incur. But we can check the statute and get back to you on that.
Well,
because the chart I have shows our payments for local governments, for example, for 2007, I believe, at $5 million, and I think the statute limits us to $10 million in repayments. But Ms. Donahoe is absolutely correct about the total. It is close to $50 million over a period of years.
Okay, so there's definitely a need out there that's not being addressed.
I don't think anyone denies that there is definitely a need.
And, Ms. Parker, you are correct. It says never exceed $10 million of repayment. I thought I heard Ms. Donahoe talk about the repayment, and maybe I misunderstood, but it's still someplace north of $40 million that we owe local jurisdictions that Senator Fishbach's constituents probably end up paying with higher property taxes. So,
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. It's just short of $50 million total that we owe to local governments today.
And we're only paying back $5 million at a crack. Is that right, Ms. Parker?
Mr. Chairman, some years it is as it appears as high as $10 million, according to the schedule I have. Mm-hmm. It's $5.3 million in 07, mm-hmm. zero in 08, 6.3 in 09, $10 million in mm-hmm. 10,
zero.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ms. Parker, it brings me to another thing. I don't, you know, I understand the need to get things done, and I've got a lot of issues in my district, just like every person does around this table, and we want to get things done. We'd like to get them done in a more above board, more straightforward manner so that we're not robbing Peter to pay Paul or, you know, increasing, you know, Senator Fischbach's constituents' property taxes or whatever. So we need to think about Chapter 161.361. You know, maybe we should just remove that from law, have you pay it all back at one time, and then knock that silliness out. And then, you know, our local jurisdictions aren't going to like that very much, but at least I think we would gain more partners in trying to do the right thing, which would be to pass a comprehensive funding package that touches even local units of government.
Chairman?
Senator Olson.
General, why was that put in? Do you know what's the history of that?
Well, let's see when it was put in. Senator Olson, looks like it was put in 1991. That would have been just about the time when we realized that 5 cent a gallon gas tax increase in 1988 wasn't enough for our local jurisdictions. So.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Dibble.
I'll defer to.
Oh, Senator Olson, you had a follow-up? Okay.
Well, it's not directly, but I just wondered, in the discussion of the mileage tax, how would that be planned to be documented, and then how would it be collected? Is there, I mean, I hear it talked about, is there any actual structural way in which you'd do it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, in the state of Oregon, they've been conducting a pilot project on the mileage tax, and that state has probably done the most in this area of any state. The way they structured it is that there's a computer chip that cars have, and they've only used new cars for this, that when you go to fill up your tank at the gas pump, there's also some computer technology that can read your odometer, basically. So it knows how many miles you traveled between fill-ups. They charged an amount per mile, it's about 1.2 cents per mile, that's equivalent to their 24 cent per gallon gas tax. And they also utilize GPS technology because it's a state system that tracked if people drove outside of the state of Oregon and didn't charge people for those miles that were driven outside of the state. So they have started a pilot project that basically allows volunteers to pay a mileage tax instead of the gas tax in order to test the technology and see how this kind of system could eventually be used. But until there's a full transition, they need to also charge the gas tax at the same time.
So, Mr. Chair and Ms. Donahue, does the so is it paid at the pump then? So it's paid when you fill up with gas, but it's determined by measuring the mileage. Thank you.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks to everyone at the table who provided this information to us. It was interesting, and just a request that that you spend a significant amount of time providing the same information in the offices of legislators who aren't necessarily in this room. I'm reasonably confident that you've got some pretty strong support here to do what we need to do, but it's a larger task than just what we can get accomplished here in this room, and that's true for both the Senate and the House. I did want to respond quickly to this notion of privatizing some of the state roadway operations, and whether it's building roads privately or operating them privately. I think it is worthy of discussing and considering and examining. I think what we'll find out, though, is that it's a pretty poor substitute for doing what we need to otherwise do, and that's find the leadership and the will to establish the resources necessary to build out a full-fledged comprehensive system. And I think we'll also find out that there really aren't any examples around the country where it's turning out as people would have hoped. And the instance you cited, SR 91 in California, actually was a failure. It was originally built privately and operated privately, and the private entity, which, by the way, also had like an easement over all the, you know, other mobility improvements in the nearby vicinity, ended up asking the public to buy the road, take it off their hands, and operate it, and that's ultimately what happened. And you see time and again with these toll roads in California, they're just not cash flowing. They're, you know, they built these, you know, beautiful kind of bypasses to increase mobility, and the tolls are just increasing beyond all reasonability, which is further driving down usage, which is creating, you know, which is screwing up their pro formas. And I think you're seeing the same happen in Texas. And Indiana sold a bunch of their roads, and the voters disapproved heartily in the last election. So it's worth looking at. I think we'll find out it's pretty much a failed experiment.
We're going to go to Senator Scoy and then Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm interested in this graph that you have here, the increase in the property tax reliance. And with your permission, I'm going to bring this into the property tax division. And I just want to make sure that I'm seeing and reading what's going on here correctly. So this graph shows me that from 2003 to 2004, there's been around $400 million of increased property taxes and special assessments for roads in Minnesota.
Mr. Chair, yes, that's correct. This is information that was gathered from the Federal Highway Administration. They track data on all states in terms of the sources of revenue for transportation, roads in particular. And from the data that was provided from MnDOT to FHWA, this is the trend that has happened in that last year.
And, Mr. Chair, to the transportation, with your permission, I'd like to use this. And do you have any idea how that line is progressing in 05 and 06?
Mr. Chair, unfortunately, it takes some time to get some of the most recent data, so I'm not sure if we can get more recent data, but we can certainly look into that for you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just following up on Senator Dibble's comments, the issue of toll roads in Minnesota, or adding, particularly in the metropolitan area, adding a third lane that would be built privately and operated privately, was that study's already been done. And former Senator Marco and I were on that study group, and everyone started out, I think, with pretty much of a blank slate, and it was just a group that was chaired by Mayor Hovland of Edina, and involved lots of stakeholders, public officials, MnDOT, you name it, any city officials, et cetera, and we were all pretty open to it, even those of us that had, you know, traditional Minnesota reluctance to go to toll roads, and as the study progressed, we became very enthusiastic about it until the money was figured in, and the private concerns that were part of this group and the experts said, you can't do it because nobody in their right mind would build this to operate it at a loss. And there was no way that they could make the numbers work to make it worthwhile for any private concern, which led to the notion that roads are as much of a subsidized transportation mode as any transit system is. And if the state would not subsidize the private concerns in building that mostly third lanes on some highways, that it just wasn't worth it. And that was a big disappointment to a lot of us on there because we had looked at maps of the metropolitan area in particular and saw that there was a real possibility of looking at dedicated lanes that were going to be toll lanes as an answer to congestion. But the price was going to be so high that you couldn't get you wouldn't have been able to get people to use it. Mr. Woffler, you talked about the thing in what in Prince William County did you say that where they they started out with what seemed like a reasonable price, but in order to make it go, it's going to be much more expensive. Now there are success stories. Once again, in the state of Virginia, the toll road that started at one of the interchanges on
Route 64.
Well, no, this is 64 going down to Virginia Beach from Norfolk, and the toll came off of that after it was paid, and it was a success where they built it, and then they had enough dollars otherwise to be able to operate it after the construction costs were paid off, but there just haven't been very many. That is a real success story there, unlike apparently what's happening in Prince William County.
So Mr. Thomas and Mr. Woffler.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ress, you're absolutely right, and I for me it's very personal. I commute back and forth to Northern Virginia each week, mm-hmm. and my wife's from Virginia Beach, so we've I use the
I drive it frequently too.
The dullest toll road four times a week, and Route 28, which is also a public-private partnership, but no tolls. It was done more, I'd say in layman's terms, basically a TIF district. And I would actually say the dullest toll road was a success. I think the problem that's happened in Virginia, though, is they've become so overly dependent upon it. Within a decade, the toll road was filled. And it is now, and so there's more maintenance costs. So the owners are raising the costs. In fact, they're having the congressman from the districts and the local officials are having a public meeting on that. The folks are up in arms at what they see is almost a 100% increase. I think there is a place for public partner, private public partnerships. I think the. We have to understand, though, that there is no it should be the exception, not the rule. I think what you're seeing in Virginia is they're, for whatever reason, raising the gas tax has just never been taken as a serious option. And for the average driver, if you commute from Leesburg, which is about 30 miles out of Washington, D.C., to the city, you not only have the dullest toll road, but then there's also a state-owned toll road that goes after that. Your commute minimum is going to be $5 each way, and that's during non-peak. And with the increase, that's going to be it's going to be close to $10 each way. And for the average person driving, you're looking at a situation where within 2 weeks, you're going to be, or I should say 2 months, you're going to be paying what you would have if you had had a gas tax for the entire year. And you also have, there's no incentive for folks that live out of Northern Virginia to get behind any kind of transportation plan because, they just build more toll roads. So it's a... why I think we ought to look at that, I think a cautious approach would be best.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson, we're not going to do any more questions. No. We're going to let Mr. Woffler go, and then we're going to adjourn.
Senator Dibble, thank you for completing what I forgot to complete, which was basically that in my conclusion on all of these in SR 91, which initially was perceived to be a success, but it was not, was largely because companies are in this for a profit,
right.
and this is not a for-profit venture in many cases, and that's the problem with this particular method.
Thank you, Mr. Wappler, Ms. Donahoe, and Mr. Thomas. And sorry, Senator Olson.
Save the topic. It'll keep.
Oh, yes, this is a topic that will simmer.
It was triggered by Senator Resnick. Mm-hmm. I will bring it up.
All right, the Transportation Committee is adjourned.